if you want to say it, in summary, represents the church. This represents the church right here. This represents the priestly services in the church. So here he says the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. He's sprinkled with blood. Well, is there a verse anywhere that says the church is purchased with blood? Acts 20:28. Well, then, are all of these things that we do in priestly service to God in the church? In other words, is our worship today sanctified by the blood of Jesus? So when you sing or commune or pray or preach or give, has that been sanctified by the blood of Jesus? Yes. You couldn't sing if it were not, and you wouldn't have any communion privileges, you see. So what he's saying is, like those old items back there, we're all sanctified with blood. By the way, class, blood represents what? Life. And every time you take the cup, you need to think of the life's blood. It can become commonplace and it can become unmeaningful if you don't think of the life's blood. Jesus' life's blood trickled out of his body, slowly and agonizingly. His life was being poured out like a drink offering. And so that was to make it possible for me to be clean, and for this book to tell me how to be clean, and for the church to be clean, which is me, and for the worship in the church to be possible. Isn't that what that means? Okay? I think it is. So he's saying you had to have a cleansing of blood, and all of that blood just really meant Jesus' blood. Jesus' life's blood. Now 23 to 28 is going to be the once and for allness. He did it once and for all instead of continually like they did. He said this before in chapter 8, didn't he? It was necessary, therefore, that the copies... Now, what does he mean by copies? Well, all these things we just mentioned, the book, the services, the tabernacle, the furniture. See, all of those are just copies of the things in the heavens, the real things, and heaven itself, should be cleansed with these. Man, he doesn't make that clear, does he? What are these? Sprinklings or sacrifices. It was necessary that all these copies should be cleansed with these. Well, I know what he must mean. The sacrifices, the cleansings. But the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices. And when he says better sacrifices, then I know he meant inferior sacrifices than these. For Christ entered not into a holy place made with hands, like in pattern to the true, like 8:5 said, a pattern, but into heaven itself. See how the high priest going into the Holy of Holies represented his going into heaven. He didn't just enter into the earthly one. Now, but into heaven itself now, to appear before the face of God for us. Jesus is right before God, just like that Holy of Holies was in the very presence of God. And that high priest, brother, went in there to face God. And he couldn't have done it without the blood he carried in there. So Jesus went right up before the face of God for us, on our behalf, as a substitute for us, as an atonement for us. Nor yet that he should offer himself, that is, it was necessary. Put an arrow from it was necessary down to that. It was necessary, therefore, that he should offer himself often. See how the Hebrew writer says it backwards? Wasn't just necessary to do that. As the high priest entereth into the holy place year by year with blood not his own, he couldn't do it with his own blood because it's sinful blood. Else must he have often suffered, Jesus, since the foundation of the world. Why is that? Because every age of the world had sin. And Jesus would have had to have suffered from the beginning and still be suffering daily. But now, once. That word once means the one time he offered his blood was adequate. It was sufficient. It did the job for all of the needs. Now, here are the needs from the beginning of the world, the foundation of the world. And people in the Hebrew writers' day are still needing cleansing by blood. And of course, all the way from the first century down to us, people are still needing cleansing by blood, right? But now, if Jesus had been like those priests, he'd have done it continually. And he couldn't have given his own blood. But he did give his own blood, meaning it was sinless. He was sinless. And he did it once. What does that mean? It's adequate. It's sufficient. It'll do the job from the foundation of the world. Let me tell you, brethren, when the Son of God died on the cross, that was something. That paid a real price. That was amazingly powerful. What it accomplished, no man could have accomplished. He did it once at the end of the ages. What ages was it at the end of? Old Testament ages, preparation ages. Hath at the end of the ages been manifest to put away sin, theirs didn't do that, by the sacrifice of himself. But how much better that is than the temporary, not sacrificing themselves. Now he's going to use a little word as, so circle as, in the middle of the word inasmuch. Inasmuch as it is appointed unto men once to die, and after this cometh the judgment, so. So tie as down to so. As this, so this. Now what is he saying? As it is appointed in the man once to die. That's his point. I bet you never ever heard a preacher make that point. I never heard preachers make that point. What do preachers always make the point? You have an appointment. You need to keep your appointment. You're going to keep your appointment. It's appointed in the man wants to die. But what's the Hebrew writer stressing? Once. It's appointed a man wants to die. That's his point. So now, it's all right to use a verse that has secondary applications, but it's not all right to not use it with its primary application. What is primary application? Once. And he's making a contrast between a man has to die once and Jesus had to die. Once. What does it mean by once? Once for all. See how he's drawing a pattern out of the Old Testament there? By the way, this verse incidentally contradicts reincarnation, doesn't it? I don't know a better verse to contradict. You ever run into any reincarnation in the Caribbean, Carter? You're saying that facetiously, aren't you? Hinduism and I don't know what all different religions believe in the reincarnation, coming back into different stages of life. And finally, you climb on up. Well, a man just dies once, doesn't he? So the main point in Hebrews 9:27 is not that we have an appointment to die, but that man dies once. And in as much as the point of men wants to die, after this comes the judgment, so. He's not talking about the judgment. He's talking about so, like men have to die once, so Christ also, having once suffered. So connect once with once, and you won't make any mistake the next time you come across this. Christ also, just like men, having been once offered to bear the sins of many, shall appear. What are you going to put over shall? Stress. Christ once offered to bear the sins of many, it doesn't mean everybody, but anybody that wants it, shall appear a second time apart from sin. Now, he came the first time to die for sin. He's not going to do that anymore. To them that wait for him unto salvation. Now, class, from the foundation of the world back over here, the blood of Jesus adequately covers everybody's sins that will accept it until he appears again unto salvation. That's what he's saying. When he says he's going to appear again a second time apart from sin unto salvation to them that wait on him, he means that everybody from Adam on down is covered in the adequacy of the sacrifice of Jesus. And he says that here, once and for all, and unto salvation. Let's read this 28th verse again. So Christ also, having been once offered to bear the sins of many, that's everybody from Adam to the end of the world, shall appear a second time. He appeared on earth the first time. He's coming in clouds a second time. Apart from sin, to them that wait on him, that are ready for him, that are eager for him, unto salvation. The word unto means purpose. What is he coming for the second time? To die for sin? No. To bring salvation. He's going to bring salvation. The Bible speaks of salvation on earth, and it speaks of salvation in heaven. It speaks of salvation in time, and it speaks of salvation at the end of time. In 2 Timothy 4:18, Paul says that the Lord will deliver me unto his eternal salvation. Paul, are you saved? Yes and no. Well, maybe that sounds wishy-washy. No, not wishy-washy. I mean, I have been saved and delivered here on earth, but I'm going to be saved one of these days, which I haven't had happen yet. Baptists put it both together. Once saved, always saved. That's why they are so nebulous about how to get saved. Boy, when you get a fellow saved, you've really got something said about him then, because he's eternally saved in heaven. Well, Paul wasn't that way. And the Hebrew writer says Jesus is coming unto salvation. Romans 13:11 says, now is our salvation nearer than when we first believed. Now, we had earthly salvation here when we first believed, but we're getting closer and closer to this eternal salvation. Any questions?
Out of place and that's going to appear a second time apart from sin. Is that saying
those waiting on him for salvation, those are apart from sin? No, I think he means apart from dying for sins. Apart from the purpose he came the first time for sin. Now it's apart from sin. He's not coming back. You see, his point is he died for sin once. He's not coming back to die for sin again. He's coming back apart from the atonement. It's already been done. Andy?
Did you say in verse 25 that nor yet that to refer back to it was necessary?
It takes up, you see. It was necessary that.
Doesn't it seem like, though, that it ought to be referring back to entered not, for Christ entered not into a copy, and for Christ entered not that he should offer himself often?
Mm-hmm, perhaps so. Perhaps that's a better, nearer reference. Okay, so the word would be what, Andy? Necessary? I mean, no, entered. Entered that he should offer. Yes, correction on that. He entered that instead of it was necessary, that. All right, another comment.
He said the judgment in verse 27 was not talking about the common judgment. He said he was talking about the judgment between once dying.
No, I didn't say it wasn't talking about the judgment. I believe it is talking about the final judgment. But I just don't believe that's his point. That's what I was trying to say. He's not trying to talk about the judgment, is he? No. He's trying to talk about that fact that a man once has to die and face the judgment was a type of Jesus dying once for all. Judgment's really not his point. That's what I was trying to say. All right, who else? Okay, now class. What we have is chapters 8 and 9 that really do spell out a tremendous difference, even chapters 7, 8, and 9, between the Old and New Covenants. If you want to really get somebody to see the difference, take them to these three chapters. They are vividly picturesque in showing that distinction. And you know, most people don't see the difference. Most people don't understand that there is a difference. Most Protestants, for instance, don't rightly divide the covenants when it is so vital. The covenants are so different. They are so opposite. Well, look at this little page right here for a moment. Brother Parker Henderson taught a class on this, and this is his chart, and I like it. And I've added some things. But he starts out, and Brother Parker teaches home studies very effectively and very thoroughly. And this is one of his home study lessons. This is one of the early ones that he studies with somebody when he's taking them through the differences between the covenants. I really think we need to spend more time showing the difference between the covenants. Because it's a matter of where you're going to go by, the old covenant or the new. Are you going to go by the Ten Commandments or not? And so in Deuteronomy 5, 1 to 3 is where he begins. And he says, God made a covenant with the Jews, not with our fathers. And he's talking about this really ought to be about 600. The fathers would be about 1500 B.C. But then in chapter 4, 13, the covenant was the Ten Commandments. I'd like for you just to mark these in your Bible with me now. So turn to Deuteronomy 5. And what we're going to mark is verse 2. Deuteronomy 5, 2. Jehovah our God made a covenant with us, underline covenant, and us. All of you remember the points we made about the covenant, that a covenant is made with two parties. Well, who are the two parties? God and us. Where? In Horeb. Jehovah made not this covenant with our fathers. Okay, so now Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's not the covenant. In fact, this covenant is opposite to that covenant. This covenant is unlike that covenant. And he says, not with our fathers, but with us, even us who are here this day. Now look back over at 4:13. He made a covenant with these people that came out of Egypt. 4:13 says, he declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even the Ten Commandments. Wrote them on two tables of stone. So now, what was the covenant that he made? Ten Commandments. Where did he write them? Two tables of stone. Now look at 9:9. In 9:9 through 11, he says, when I was gone up, Moses speaking, to receive the tables of stone, even the tables of the covenant, he says that again in verse 11, he gave me the two tables of stone, even the tables of the covenant. So, brethren, what was the covenant? Tables. What was on the table? Ten Commandments. Now, this is how Brother Parker says that you can teach people that the covenant meant the Ten Commandments, and we're not under the Ten Commandments anymore. And the Ten Commandments were the covenant, and the covenant now is ended. And look at down at the bottom of his page, names that described the first covenant. It was old. I put out beside that faulty. There's the faulty covenant, and there's the perfect covenant. Decayed, vanished, changed, disannulled, weak, unprofitable, shadow, the one taken away, blotted out, nailed to the cross, broken down, abolished, cast out, the one we're not under. It's the letter that kills, it's the ministration of death, engraven on stone. Its glory was passing away, it had lesser glory. It was a ministration which condemned. You know, the word minister means serve. Now, suppose there's a waiter in a restaurant, and he has a platter, and he says, you want some of this that I'm serving? You say, yes, give me some. And it's condemnation. Well, now, that's what the law covenant served you. How would you like a little condemnation? Got it right here. How about a little death? It's a ministration of death. That's exactly what it was. And it's the one that was really given when a veil was on the heart. Now look at this that I'll have to sort of interpret to you here. In 2 Corinthians 3, see the handwriting on the wall? 2 Corinthians 3, 1 to 17 is me. It's not Parker. But I have listed parallel the contrasts. Paul makes the contrast between the covenant that's written in tables of stone and written in hearts by the Spirit. See that? I want you to underline those distinctions. Not of the letter which killeth, but of the Spirit which giveth life. Man, that's quite different, wouldn't you say? Ministration of death engraven on stones, ministration of the Spirit. Ministration of condemnation and ministration of righteousness. He said that one had glory, but this one has greater glory. That glory passeth away, this glory surpasseth. He makes a play on the word passeth. That one passeth away, this one surpasseth, or remaineth. That was the one that they had when they put a veil on Moses' face, and they still have a veil on their heart. But over here, we don't have a veil. We look into the unveiled face of Jesus, beholding the glory of the Lord. And over here, their minds are hardened, but over here, their minds are transformed. Over here, there's bondage. Over there, there's liberty by the Spirit. Over there, there was condemnation in the face of Moses, and they didn't even want to look on Moses' face. It was so awesome. But over there, there's mercy in the face of Jesus. So that's the tremendous difference. I've also tried to put it in three little segments down here. I've mentioned to you several times how I believe there are three segments of time. Those under the covenant with Abraham, those under the covenant with Moses, and those under the covenant with Jesus. And really, the one that is in contrast is the middle one. The other two are identical. It's the one in the middle that's the unlike covenant. Now notice Deuteronomy 5:3 we read just a minute ago says, "What made with your fathers?" Why did he say that? Because that one was so different. The covenant he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was so different from the one he made on Sinai. Why? One with Abraham brings life. This one brings death. This one brings liberty. That one brings slavery. See? So the real picture of the difference between covenants is the unlike covenant of Moses. And it's put right in the middle of the other two for you to see that difference. Okay, let's take us a break right there. Now our second session is always more interesting, even though it's sleepier time, because we have more participation. And you feel free to speak out and ask questions. In the cafeteria, Fred Dartard here was asking me about the sins of ignorance, as if maybe he means only the ignorant sins were being forgiven on the Day of Atonement. And I was saying that there are at least 10 synonyms in the New Testament for sin. This is one of them. And like the word adultery, adultery literally means adulterating a marriage. And married people can only do that. But sometimes the word can be used generally, not specifically. And the context will tell you whether it means married people or whether it's just a general word for sexual unfaithfulness. Now, the words for sin are used like that. Sometimes they will be specific. Like, for instance, in 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11, he mentions adultery and fornication. Well, then those are specific. See, they're put side by side. But I was feeling, as I told Fred, that even though this word has a specific meaning, since it's the only word used, and the context sounds like that it meant those sins were forgiven on the Day of Atonement, that it's used in general. It's used with a general connotation. Otherwise, we would have only people's ignorant sins forgiven on them. Well, then Carter said, well, perhaps that means somebody over here, was it? Monty said, maybe then the deliberate sins were covered by the daily sacrifice. Now, when you go through Leviticus, you don't find it lined up that way. But look with me, if you will, at Numbers chapter 15, if you'd like to see the distinction that is made between those two things. He says, I'm trying to see the ignorant ones. 22, Numbers 15, 22. When ye shall err, and shall not observe all the commandments which Jehovah hath spoken, even all that Jehovah hath commanded, then it shall be, if it be done unwittingly. See that? Unwittingly? Meaning in error, without knowing. Without the knowledge of the congregation, that all the congregation shall offer certain sacrifice. Now look at verse 27. If one person shall sin unwittingly, see this is the whole congregation first, now it's the one person, then the priest shall make atonement for the soul that erreth when he sinneth unwittingly. Says unwittingly in verse 29. But now 30. This is the opposite kind of sin. Really, there are just two kinds of sins here. But the soul that doeth aught with a high hand, whether he be homeborn or sojourner, the same blasphemeth Jehovah, he be cut off. Why? He hath despised the word of Jehovah. He hath broken his commandment that that soul shall be utterly cut off. His iniquity shall be upon him. Now, the example of that is verse 33, the fellow who's picking up sticks on Sabbath. He knew better than doing that. He just did it deliberately. And so here is the distinction in the Old Testament. All sins either fall into the wittingly or unwittingly. And the sins that are done wittingly have no sacrifice. There is no sacrifice. Well, now, you have to take that with all of the things where he says there is a sacrifice. So now let's let Hebrews explain that. And it works both ways. The Old Testament explains the New, but the New Testament explains the Old. Look at Hebrews 10, 26. For if we sin willfully, after that we've received the knowledge of the truth, there remaineth no more sacrifice for sin. Now that's a direct reference to number 15. That there are sins for which there is no sacrifice. Well, now, what kind of sins are they? Well, look at verse 29. Who hath trodden underfoot the Son of God? Here's the sin he's talking about that has no sacrifice. And hath counted the blood of the covenant with an unholy thing, wherewith he was sanctified. And hath done despite unto the Spirit of grace. God's going to punish that fellow. So now, what is the New Testament explanation of the Old Testament presumptuous sin? That a man can continue in presumption until he is so deliberate and rebellious that God can't forgive him. Now, that's what that's talking about right there. What's he done? He's been sanctified, but he counts the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified unholy. He's trodden underfoot the Son of God. He's done despite in the Spirit of grace. You see how that's not just an act, is it? So the Old Testament does not mean to teach that there are certain acts that cannot be forgiven. But rather it is teaching, watch it there when you do those things that indicate presumption, because they lead you to a condition of heart that cannot be forgiven. Jordan?
Okay, as Christ told us on the Sermon on the Mount, not to judge, and to forgive, if you're to be forgiven, unless you be judged.
Yes.
If you are in Christ, and yet you choose not to forgive, how far can you go before you will be to the point where you will not be forgiven?
See, that you stated it right when you said, how far can you go? You enter into a practice of presumption. And that's what the Hebrew writer is talking about when he says, if we sin willfully, after that we receive the knowledge of the truth. He doesn't mean if we do a thing willfully, because everybody does that. But he means if you do enough of those things, you'll become willful in attitude, and you'll become habitually willful, and you have a presumptuous rebellion that you can't be forgiven for. So when the Hebrew writer explains it as an attitude of heart that has become a habitual way of life, then I know what the Old Testament was typifying and pre-picturing. That's the explanation that I believe the blaspheme of the Spirit needs. God is not saying, I will not forgive a certain sin. He's simply saying, what these men did was to see a miracle. They knew it was a miracle, but they were so hardened that they said, rather than accept Jesus, Son of God, we're going to say he did it by the power of the devil. Well, Jesus said, that hath not forgiveness. So it was their attitude of heart, it was their depth of rebellion that was unforgivable, not the incident, that merely expressed it.
If today, what would be blasphemy?
Well, he says there in Mark 3 that this is an eternal sin that hath never forgiveness, for they said he had an unclean spirit. Now, if you today see a miracle, which you can't, and say that Jesus did it by the power of the devil, that indicates your heart is that hard. Now, there's some things you can do, I suppose, that would indicate that, but that's what I know the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit is. And you ask me, what today can we do that's like it? Well, there's a bunch of those, but I know what that is, you see. I know that's what they did. So, Fred, I think that's what the Old Testament was pre-picturing, because that's what the New Testament said it was pre-picturing. Good question. Now, does somebody else have a question? Or anything on that?
Sin willfully then in Hebrews 10 is a continual
sin. Yes, and it's a condition. 2 Peter 3 says in verse 14, they cannot cease from sin. Well, that's why they can't be forgiven. In 1 John 1, 9, he says, if we confess our sins, he's faithful and righteous. Now, any sin you confess, God will forgive. But there are sins that men continue, they won't quit, and even can't quit. So then they don't have any forgiveness. And we need to really be careful with presumptuous acts, because a presumptuous act demonstrates an attitude of presumption. But let's face facts, brethren. All people have presumption. We all do deliberate things we know are wrong. And I think it is totally inaccurate to say today that God will forgive me if I don't know, but he won't if I do know, because, brother, you're lost and you're a goner if that's your attitude. There is no person that does not deliberately sin today. If you know him, let me know his name, would you? Now let's talk about Sabbatarianism. Sabbatarianism is a plague upon our present world. Where did it start? With a little lady named Mrs. Ellen G. White. Look at this page, a false prophet. Here is Critic Ford, who is a defrocked Sabbatarian scholar. And what's happened is he knew more about Mrs. Ellen G. White's writings than anybody else. He was the most famous for that. He's Sabbatarian, Seventh-day Adventist. And since he knows so much about them, he has said that she plagiarized. And he even documents the hundreds and thousands of places where she took the writings from. And so he's caused a uprising or an unsettling situation in Sabbath, among Sabbath people. Now look at this page, which says, Founders Writing Spark Rue. I think they mean row, don't you? I would have spelled it differently, but I know what you mean. Founders Writing Spark Row. We have plenty of those in the Lord's Church, so I know what those are. A controversy of historic sweep is smoldering in Seventh-day Adventist Church, resulting in the defrocking of two prominent ministers. First such penalties since the turn of the century. It's been 1800 since that happened. We've got a purge on, one of them said. Skip on down now. There's been nothing like this basically in our history. Yet so far there have been no major ripples, he says. We don't feel it's going to split us, but it may come to examining our teaching more deeply. Well, I hope so. With 600,000 U.S. members and 3.5 million worldwide, the church is known for Sabbath, Saturdays, health disciplines, extensive missions, medical work, and the soon coming of Jesus. At the crux of the dispute is the weight given the voluminous writings of a founder, Ellen G. White, in relation to the Bible, and questions about just how much of those writings were really her own. Recent Adventist tendencies have made her a myth and an idol. That's what this researcher is saying. Desmond Ford of New Castle, California, stripped of his ministerial credentials for challenging her. Her teachings have been misused as a basis for doctrine, almost as a substitute for the Bible. It's something she would have shrunk from. Then he says, much of her writing was copied from others. She copied and borrowed for almost everything. Some of this was known before, but not the immense extent of it. What we now discover magnifies it tremendously. Much of it is at the very heart of the theology. He says the shocking amount of her copying is being concealed from the lay members and minimized by the administration. They're downplaying it, but they can't deny it. This is more damaging if they just tell the truth, but it's not going to go away. Now, what essentially he's saying is, how can she be inspired and how can she be a prophetess? Now, this is one of her own people. If she plagiarized nearly everything. Look at the top of the next column. She was charismatic, inspired, but not the final word. Now, brother, if she's inspired, then she was the final word. And so this fellow says, I'm going to stay with this Sabbath church, but she wrote 46 books, and he has found plagiarism in nearly all of them. Look at the last paragraph. I have great respect for Ms. White. She was a loving, lovable Christian, but she refused to decide doctrine. She said, don't depend on my writing. Go to the Bible. But the church has gotten away from that, and that's tragic. He says, I'm going to stay with the Seventh-day Adventists. Very similar thing down here. This came out of the Avalanche Journal in 1980 in Lubbock, Texas. This came out of Newsweek, if you'd like to state where it came from. What's down there? January 1981. So 4 or 5 years ago, this was happening. And this kind of thing is happening all the time. Mormonism is wide open to that kind of thing because there are so many of their books that are so easy to just shoot holes all in and shoot holes in them themselves if you just know where to look. But now, I'd like for us to look at the tract on Sabbatarian eras. I put this together in Nigeria because Sabbatarianism was so strong. Anybody need a tract? If you're ever going to be a missionary anywhere, you're going to need to know Sabbatarianism. And I learned it the hard way. I went to Nigeria and didn't know anything about it, but I learned it when I got there. Pass it back to Roger, please. Okay. Go. Everybody got one? All right, on the first page, what I have is two columns trying to show the doctrine opposing the verses. For Gentiles, why don't you underline with me? They say the law was for Gentiles. Underline for Gentiles. Romans 2:14, the Gentiles have not the law. Point number two, Jews' religion. Galatians 1:13, Paul was in the Jews' religion and made havoc of the church. By the way, class, what does Jews apostrophe mean? What does that apostrophe indicate? Well, it's plural, but the apostrophe represents what? Possessive. So it's plural possessive. Meaning what? It was theirs. And that's what we were dealing with a while ago when we said when covenants were made with people, whether it was even in the Bible or outside of the Bible, they start out with the dominant victorious king saying, I'm the God that whipped you, or I'm the king who defeated you. And so God starts out and says, I'm the God which led you out of the land of Egypt. And so it was a covenant with them. And Paul calls it the Jews' religion. When we were in Nigeria, we couldn't own land. Only Nigerians can own land in Nigeria. So we would say, why is that? Isn't it because it's the Nigerians' land? And they could understand that. Just like the Jews was the Jews' religion. Now, you could become a Jew and have it, but you had to be one. You had to proselyte. Number three, addressed to all men. But Ezekiel 20, I gave them my statutes and showed them my judgments and gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them. You remember our study of covenants, there was some kind of sign or token of the covenant. Now, Ezekiel said that the token of the covenant, the tables, were a sign between me and them. So the Ten Commandments are not a sign between me and God. They're a sign between that people that he called out of Egypt. Number four, they say not made with Israel only. But 1 Kings 8:9 says, the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. Number five, Sabbatarians say that the Sabbath was kept from creation. But Nehemiah 9:14 says, made us known them, unto them thy holy Sabbath. God came down on Mount Sinai and made us known unto them thy holy Sabbath. The reason it sounds like it's kept from the beginning is Moses wrote it in the days of Moses. See, Moses wrote about the creation of everything in 6 days and resting on the seventh. He wrote that after the law was given. And so he put in the Genesis account what would point toward the Sabbath day in his day. But it didn't mean that God hallowed it for them to keep back there. How do you know that? Well, this says he made it known to them on Sinai. Couldn't that mean they already knew it? No. Because certainly there would have been a record of people keeping the Sabbath is an important thing. See, that's the central thing to Sabbatarians. But is there any indication that any place between Genesis and Exodus 20 anybody ever kept the Sabbath? No. So then, it must be that when Moses wrote about the 7 days of creation after the law of the Sabbath was already given, in other words, he wrote it in his own lifetime, that he made it point to that, and it sounds like he hallowed it and sanctified it back there, which he didn't. He made it known on Sinai. Where's the verse? Nehemiah 9:14. Then, 6, they say it's perpetual for everyone, forever. But repeatedly, you can find such statements as this, they're to keep the Sabbath throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant. So it's not perpetual for everybody forever, it's perpetual for them throughout their generations. 7, the Sabbatarians say the Sabbath is perpetual, but the other things that the Bible says perpetual, they don't say are perpetual. Like, for instance, incense. Look at Exodus 38. It is a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generation. Well, they don't keep incense. They don't keep the priesthood, but it was perpetual. They don't keep the firstborn being sanctified, but it was perpetual. So then, why do they just pick out one thing and say perpetual? 8, they make a difference between God's Ten Commandments, and Moses' Book of the Law. So they say God's law was not Moses' law, that Moses' law was the Book of the Law. But brethren, when Moses read the Book of the Law, he also read the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were just the actual writings of the finger of God, but the Book of the Law still had that in it. And this, they would say, are the tablets. You see that God made these a lot more important than those because these are the law of God and that's the law of Moses. Then they make this the moral law. And I hear some of my brethren talking like this. And this the ceremonial law. Meaning the feasts and the various festivals and things like that. So they make a arbitrary decision that the Bible does not make. Now, the Bible just says the law. The Bible never talks about the parts of the law. It never uses the moral law and the ceremonial law. Now, it does talk about the Book of the Law and the tablets, but that's the only distinction they can base everything on. But now look at Mark 7:10. Moses said, honor thy father and mother. So Moses said the Ten Commandments. Ezra 7:6, the law of Moses which the Lord had given. See, so Moses' law was given by the Lord. These verses erase that distinction. 2 Chronicles 31:3, the new moons and the offerings and the Sabbaths and the set feasts written in the law of the Lord. Well, they would put the things over here, you see, the new moons and feasts, but this says in the law of the Lord. If you want one to remember, you can easily remember Luke 2. That's the birth of Jesus story. It starts a Christmas story. I'm glad I didn't say Christmas. And when the days of her purification according to the law of Moses, underlying law of Moses, were accomplished, they brought him to Jerusalem and presented him to the Lord as written in what? Law of the Lord. So put a line in the law of Moses, the law of the Lord, because they did it according to the law of Moses as it's written the law of the Lord. So those are the same thing, aren't they? Then, here's one of the things they don't do, and that's sanctify the firstborn, Exodus 13. They say God's laws are not changed, but Hebrews 7:12 says the change also of the law. And the one that we would always bear down on was Exodus 35:3, ye shall kindle no fire. And then verse 2 says, If any man doeth any work therein, he should be put to death. So the Sabbath law said, don't kindle a fire. And the Sabbath law said, if you do, kill him. And Numbers 15, we just didn't read far enough a minute ago. And Moses took it to the Lord, and they killed him, they stoned him. So, the law of Moses, the Sabbath law said, don't burn, don't even do that much work on Saturday, and kill him if you do. So, what I would generally press harder than anything is, you do kindle a fire. The Nigerians would all build fires on Saturday, because they cooked with open fire. And they never put anybody to death. And I would say, I thought you were Sabbath people. I thought you were Sabbatarians. The Sabbath law says, and they just never could wiggle out. We really rubbed that in. We're probably a little bit unkind on that. Now look at the chart which says the Sabbath law was given to Israel only. These verses say, and Glenda, these are places where he just repeats it. I did it when I brought you out of Egypt to the people at Mount Sinai, not made with your fathers. People brought out of bondage in Egypt. But see, now that's the typical covenant process. First thing you do is you say, I'm the God, or it might be, I'm the king who did this. Well, God said, I'm the God brought you out of Egypt. That's what I've done. Now, thou. Who is thou? That's a pronoun. Who's it refer back to? The one brought out of Egypt. So every one of the Ten Commandments is addressed to the people brought out of Egypt. You say, well, later Jews weren't brought out of Egypt. No, but that nation was. And that covenant was with that nation. And I'm not in that nation. And if I get a letter addressed to you and I take it to myself, that's wrong. But every one of these Ten Commandments is addressed to those people and not to me. Thou. So that's what all of these under this charter say. Now the bottom one, you need to revise the title of it. Don't say the old law. I quit saying that. I've learned something since I put that. Put the old covenant. Or you might just say the law. I don't read about the old law, and I don't read about the new law. I do read about the law. So the law was nailed to the cross. And why don't you go through and hit dead to the law, delivered from the law. Can't marry two laws. Nailed to the cross. Blotted out. Made old. Makes faith void. Not under. No flesh justified. Christ is the end of the law, the purpose of it. Taken out of the way. Not now to keep. Law now abolished. Done away. Now changed. First taken away. Here's where we were last week. No effect to law keepers. Christ no effect. Fallen from grace. Christ's death vein, schoolmaster, no longer a schoolmaster, new and better covenant. Now there are two places that I have found it, maybe three, easier to teach which law. This section now says, they will always say, well now, sure, the law is dead, we're not under the law, but which law are you talking about? They'll say we're not under this law. But see, they arbitrarily make that distinction. God doesn't make that distinction. God just says we're not under the law. And so here are three places that you can easily prove that we're not under the Ten Commandments. We just got through reading from Deuteronomy 5 and 4 and 9 how the covenant was the Ten Commandments. So now every verse in the Bible that says we're not under the old covenant or we're not under the first covenant would mean the Ten Commandments. But here he says we're delivered from the law and we're dead to the law. But in verse 7 he says it's the one that says thou shalt not covet. So the one we're dead to is the one that says don't covet. That's one of the Ten Commandments, isn't it? Exodus 20:17. And their answer to that will be, well, verse 7 says, is the law sin? See, they already know what to answer, and that is, he's not saying the law is sin. But this verse shows what law is dead. Then Colossians 2:14, the ordinances are nailed to the cross, and verse 16 says, don't let anybody then require you to keep the Sabbath. So since the law is dead, it must have been the Sabbath law, because it says the one that you can't be required to keep. In 2 Corinthians 3, I was giving you this on the page a minute ago like that, but it's the one which was given when Moses veiled his face. Which one was that? Ten Commandments. It was the one written on stones, and it's the one that is read in the synagogues. So that's the Ten Commandments. And yet that's the one, he says, is a ministration of death, a ministration of condemnation. So don't ever let them tell you that the part of the law is done away. Then down here, well, let's go over those more one by one. So one which said, thou shalt not covet, we just did that. Written and engraven on stones, when they couldn't behold Moses' face, when he veiled his face, when you read the old covenant. Then Colossians 2, Hebrews 8, it's the one when God led him out of Egypt. The one which said, thou shalt not kill, that's the Ten Commandments. One which said not commit adultery, that's the Ten Commandments. And it's always just called the law, never part of the law. There were not two laws, but one. And here Hilkiah found the book of the Lord given by Moses. See, now that's what these are that we were doing just a minute ago. Now the bottom of this page says the better covenant has better commandments. That is, and I canceled out old law there again. But Jesus would often say, you've heard it said, but I say. And Ephesians 4:28 says, not to steal, but he says, work with the hands that you might give. So that's a far better commandment than just not to steal. And on the top of the back, we have the Ten Commandments repeated and elevated, except for the Sabbath, where we have the first day of the week in number 4. Now, there are Bible reasons for first-day worship. One of them is that Jesus was raised on the first day of the week. Mark 16:9. 1 Corinthians 11 says that's the center of everything. And 1 Corinthians 15 says if that didn't happen, then nothing else matters. Then the church was established on Sunday. How do you know that? Well, it was established on the day of Pentecost, which Leviticus 23:15 says was the morrow after the seventh Sabbath. So here is Passover week, and Passover ended with a Sabbath. And they were to take the morrow after that Sabbath and count seven Sabbaths, and that'll be a Sabbath. But then you take the morrow after that seventh Sabbath, and that's a holy day. Now that's where the day of Pentecost always occurred. The other feasts could vary, but their Pentecost always was on Sunday. Why? Because always a mar after the Sabbath. So this is the day that the church was established. And then?
Brother Matthew, what would be the answer to that one?
I've never heard him give an answer to that. I have a little book with all of their teachings, all of the Bible answers, and then all of their answers to those. And this is by Cecil Wright, I believe is his name, and it's put out by Star Bible Publications. It's called Sabbatarian Encyclopedia. Maybe I can bring it to class. But it does give the quibbles that come along. So, the other reasons are communion was on the first day of the week, Acts 20 and verse 7. And giving was on the first day of the week. Specifically stated, 1 Corinthians 16:2. And strangely enough, in Nigeria, the Sabbatarians would have their communion on Sunday. They would actually have a day of communion and have it on Sunday. So, we need to know how they twist the idea of the law, and then how they don't see the new covenant and the day of the new covenant and the purpose of the old covenant. Pardon?
They use every instance of the apostles going into the synagogue. Mm-hmm. They use every instance that not prove it.
That's right.
And here's what the apostles are doing, and they're doing it on Thursday, and that's what.
That's right. And Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus. And they say the Lord's Day is the Sabbath because Jesus was Lord of the Sabbath. So that makes the Lord's Day the Sabbath day. And not only that, Carter, but every time they see the word commandments in the Bible. In Revelation 22:14, blessed are they that keep his commandments, they'll enter into the city. They say that's the Ten Commandments. Every time they see commandments, they think Ten Commandments. But now the sad thing, and this I bring out down at the bottom, is they really don't see the purpose of the law. They don't see that the law was to point out man's sin and need for Jesus. They don't see how the law was inadequate and unable. They don't see the difference between law and grace. They mix it. And a lot of our brethren don't see that. They believe we're under a better law, a stricter law, which means we're just going to be worse condemned, doesn't it? But the law came by Moses, and grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. John 1, what? 17. In Romans 6:14, sin shall not have dominion over you, not under law, but under grace. Galatians 3:21, if there had been a law, man, that's a clear verse to me. If there had been a law that could have brought life, then surely it would have been by the law of Moses.
So that's what they answer to. The verse Paul wrote in Romans, for what the law
could not do. Well, they say you need something with the law. You need the new covenant with the law. The law couldn't do it, so Jesus added the new covenant onto it.
Hmm? I have a question. It might be a little bit off, but on the other hand, it might be why did God pick the first day of the week?
One reason, obviously, is to show the unlikeness of the two covenants. You can't get any, I don't think, more unlike than first and last. Maybe you could, but I mean, that seems to me to be a real contrast. And then, first is the most important. Every time first, anything is most important, would be my answer to that. All right, good questions. I like this section because I like to hear your questions. What is the Hebrew writer saying about the law? He's saying it so different, so inadequate. And anytime he talks about the priesthood, he's really talking about the law. Anytime he talks about the covenant, the basis of it is the law. Anytime he talks about the sacrifice, whatever it is, he's really talking about the law. So then when you put Hebrews and Romans and Galatians together and see that they're really all contrasting these things, and I have brethren that just really argue with me when I try to show that this is a contrast. This is a tremendous difference that God is making. And so really what God is showing is that the law could not save because he wants us to see how Christ must save. The kind of thing law is could not justify it, to show us that only faith can justify. Now, who has a question? All right, we have some deliberations going over here. While they're doing that, let's talk some more about study skills. What are the study skills? What's the first one? Theming the Bible. Landis and Will and some others, when they teach home studies, teach the scheme of redemption. I'd really like to hear Landis do that. A fellow he stayed with heard him do that and gave him $40. Isn't that right, brother? Well, now, he was impressed, wasn't he?
Yes, sir.
Well, I think a man has to see the end from the beginning. I believe we have to see the whole picture. If we don't, we're lost. We're drowning. And you say, well, how can I see the whole picture? Well, you do it two ways. You let the parts help you see the whole, and you let the whole help you see the parts. And we teach a course, Scheme of Redemption, that can help you do that. But main thing is you just see where the Bible's going, see what the theme and thread and stream running through it is. What's skill number two? Old Testament backgrounding, foundationing by the Old Testament. We certainly couldn't ever understand the New Testament without the Old. We couldn't understand Hebrews by all means, could we? And as a group, the Church of Christ has neglected the Old Testament. We just really don't know the Old Testament. So I think it's high time, brethren, that we have a restoration movement. I want to start a restoration movement among preachers first. I think we need to restore the gospel of grace, which most gospel preachers are a little timid about. Then we need to restore evangelism like it was in the Bible. I believe we need to restore Bible study like it was and meant to be in the Bible. So, what I would like for us to do is to really give ourselves to the study of the Old Testament. And the way to do that is to become good friends with every book in the Old Testament. We have a little checkup test here at IBC, and it's horrifying to see how the students don't know Old Testament books. They don't know what certain books are even about. They couldn't tell you a single thing about some of the Old Testament books. And yet they're so vital. And this morning in our general epistles class, 2 Peter chapter 1, 20 to 21, Peter says, "We have the word of prophecy made more sure, like a lamp in a dark place, until the day star dawn in your hearts, until the dawn of Christ comes." Now, what he was saying was the Old Testament prophecies were in the dim, dark past. It was dark back there, but they were lamps pointing to Christ, the Messiah. But now that the apostles had come and given their eyewitness testimony that the Old Testament prophecies meant Jesus, then that makes the prophecies more sure. They were sure because God said them, but they were more sure because the apostles and their eyewitness testimony had fulfilled them, had shown them to be fulfilled. And then he says it's like the day star dawning and it's like the sunrise. So what we need to do is to see that the Old Testament is the preparation and the dawning and the pointing toward the Messiah. When we get to chapter 12, I'd like to give you a study that I've made on the kingdom. It really helped me to study the Bible-wide concept of the kingdom, because the chapter 12 is going to deal with the kingdom. And here's a little something I did tonight, just off the cuff. How are we coming over there, brother? I'm getting impatient with you. Are you doing any good?
Well, we can't hear you through here, but you're picking up here, so I can be okay. I'm going to take it on this one if you don't get you.
Okay, that's good. I'd like to get this on the tape. Now, we don't study the Bible just to answer errors. That's one of the mistakes we make. But it will answer errors. If we study to answer errors, we'll get it out of balance. And we'll probably see things that are not there. But there is a prevailing doctrine that permeates almost every Protestant group, and that is dispensational premillennialism. And here's what they believe. They really believe in the Old Testament. They study it far better than we do. They are close students of the prophecies of Christ, the Messiah, and the kingdom. But here's their weakness. They believe in the actual, literal fulfillment of all Old Testament prophecies of Christ in the kingdom. In other words, when he says, "The lamb will lie down with the lion," it's really going to be a lamb and a lion. And they don't believe in figurizing any of that. Therefore, when we come to the New Testament, they say there is no such fulfillment in the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John don't do that. There is no Israel restored. You see, they believe literal Israel has to be restored. Well, the prophet said that, didn't they? And the priesthood and the sacrifices and the Sabbath and the temple, if you've ever studied Ezekiel, he says that. He even gives the dimensions of the temple and of the altars and of the washings and everything about it. Therefore, they say, since we don't see any literal fulfillment when Jesus came, something happened. Well, what was that something? They speculate that because the Jews rejected him as king, of course, they didn't reject him as that kind of king. They rejected him as the kind of king he really was. But if he'd have been the kind of king they wanted, they wouldn't have rejected him. But they rejected him as king, and therefore, there was this postponement period. The postponement in which the church age was put in. That is, the kingdom is coming, and in Mark 1:15 even says it's at hand. Jesus and John said it's at hand. The time is fulfilled. The kingdom is at hand. But it was postponed. Now, what's going to happen, according to them, is at the end of the church age, in which we're presently coming to the end of it, we're close to the end of it, is going to be a rapture. This is a term the Bible never uses, a concept it never uses, in which the faithful are going to be caught up. There's going to be a seven-year great tribulation period here on earth, but we're going to be with the Lord. Then he's coming back, and there's going to be the thousand-year kingdom in which Israel will be restored. Israel will rule the nations. There will be peace. There won't be any war. And the Prince of Peace will sit on the actual chair of David. That is, Jesus will come back to Jerusalem and reign Israel and the nations. Well, that's very thrilling and sensational and exciting to people. It makes headlines in their thinking. And they tie it all with events in history, in the going of Israel, the nation of Israel that's been restored, you know. But now let me show you what's wrong with that as far as the book of Hebrews is concerned. In the book of Hebrews, we have all of these Old Testament types, like, for instance, the tabernacle and the sacrifices and the priesthood. I mean, everything in Hebrews is a type. The type of Moses and Christ. You remember all of those. Now, the types, according to Hebrews chapter 10 that we're studying tonight, imply the antitype. I like to define type as a pre-picture and antitype as a fulfilled picture. So, all of these things are not the real thing. The real thing is here. But when you study the book of Hebrews, you find out that the new covenant is the real thing. Where in the new covenant is any prophecy of anything that's real if this isn't the real thing? If the types were not fulfilled in the antitypes in the new covenant, then where are they going to be fulfilled? Well, they say they're all going to be fulfilled. Well, where's that in the New Testament? The New Testament says they were fulfilled. And tonight we have a very strong chapter on that between the type and the antitype. Because, see, what they believe is this type back here was really saying that it's going to be a literal priesthood and sacrifices and Sabbath. And yet Hebrews 10 is saying, no, we can't get any forgiveness out of bloody Old Testament sacrifices. We can't get any forgiveness out of that old covenant. But you see, dispensationalism says that old covenant is going to be restored over here. Boy, that's so illogical. That means then that we don't have the real thing yet. We don't really have the forgiveness of our sins yet. In Acts 2, Jesus was raised from the dead to sit on David's throne so that the remission of sins could be preached. But now, if he wasn't raised to sit on David's throne, if he's really going to later sit on David's throne, then we don't have any forgiveness of our sins tonight. And it is so unthinkable that the good students that these people are would say that we're going back to the blood sacrifices of the old covenant. Now, it's really what they say. And what you and I need to do is to see from the book of Hebrews and from the whole New Testament how this just can't be. Because there are people that are just thrilled to pieces with it. Have you ever used the Scofield Reference Bible? See, you have. I grew up on Scofield Reference Bible. That thing is thrilling. It outlines everything. It's paragraphs and it cross-references. But it's premillennial, it's dispensational. One of the mistakes I think that I made when I came along was thinking that premillennialism is just a few little ideas about a thousand-year reign in Revelation 20. Brother, that is so shallow a view. Premillennialism is an entirely different concept of the whole scheme of redemption. You and I need to see that scheme of redemption. We need to see how this book, especially the book of Hebrews, is helping. Any question on that? Let me generate and challenge your thinking on that. Roger?
We were talking about this in class last night, and someone brought up a very good point. God says repeatedly that he is not a special person.
Mm-hmm.
If he establishes a thousand-year kingdom and reestablishes Israel and Jews, then he becomes a special person.
Of Well, that's
a good point. Right,
that's true. And there's just so many good points.
Yeah.
Now let's look back at Hebrews 9, 23 to 28. Here is where he really begins talking about the sacrifices. Tonight we're talking about the better sacrifices of the better covenant by the better priesthood. It was necessary, therefore, that the copies of the things in the heavens, that Jesus and his rule and his tabernacle are now in heaven. And the copies of these things had to be cleansed with these sacrifices. But the heavenly things, so he calls them the things in the heavens, the heavenly things, themselves be cleaned, understood, cleansed, understood, with better sacrifices than these. So it's like earthly things were cleansed with earthly sacrifices, but heavenly things had to be cleansed with better sacrifices. For Christ entered not into a holy place made with hands. That was the old original tabernacle. Like in pattern to the true. Do you hear him saying type and antitype there? Wasn't that the real true tabernacle back then? No, it was just like in pattern to the true. The true one is the one in heaven where Jesus is right now. But he didn't enter into that one. He entered into heaven itself, comma, now to appear before the face of God for us. So Jesus now is high priest in the true tabernacle before the face of God, making intercession for us, just like those old priests made intercession to God daily in the old tabernacle. Nor yet that he should offer himself often. We go back to it was necessary now. Nor yet was it necessary that he should offer himself often as the high priest entereth into the holy place, year by year with the blood, not his own. Of course, it couldn't be his own because he was not sinless. His own blood had to be paid for his own sins, and he couldn't pay for anybody else's. Else must he often have suffered since the foundation of the world, but now, once at the end of the ages, hath he been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. See, much better that is than the old types were. And insomuch as it is appointed unto men once to die, and after this come the judgment, so Christ also, having been once offered, that's his point, that's his comparison, to bear the sins of many, that doesn't mean the elect, it means anybody that will accept him, shall appear, emphasis on shall appear a second time, apart from sin, to them that wait for him unto salvation. So, the old covenant sacrifices were continuous, year by year, regular, even daily. But, Jesus' sacrifice is going to last until he comes again. And the once appointment of death is typical of the once Jesus made a sacrifice. And brother, that once is going to do it. Just like you're not going to die but once. There's no such thing as transmigration of the soul or reincarnation. I'm reading from the Mormons now, and they had in Reader's Digest, we once lived, we live now, we'll live eternally. They believe in reincarnation, all that. Well, Jesus once died, just like a man once dies. That's the point of this comparison. Now, he says, for, and I think that goes back to the paragraph we just read, it was necessary for him to make the sacrifice for the law having a shadow of the good things to come. Have I not told you many times that what we're really talking about is the difference between the law and the gospel? We're talking about the outworkings of the law and the institutions of the law. But folks, we're really just talking about the law. The law was carnal ordinances, and what we're dealing with is the death of Christ. So, the book of Hebrews is really restating the basic contrast of the book of Romans and the book of Galatians, and that is the difference between law and grace. And there is such a vivid difference between those two bases of our salvation that we need to see it. So now he calls attention to the law. He's talking about the sacrifices, but really the sacrifices were just instituted by the law. The law is what brought the sacrifice. The law having a shadow of good things to come. Well, that doesn't mean there's still good things to come, does it? Over the word come, put 9:11, which says, Christ having come, a high priest of the good things to come. When were they good things to come? In the Old Testament. So the book of Hebrews is written, if you'll notice, from the viewpoint of the Old Testament person. He writes everything as if he's thinking of it in the eyes and the mind of that person. Look at verse 26 above. But now, once at the end of the ages. What end of the what ages is he talking about there? Old Testament ages. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul says that as well. He says that these things happen to them by way of example written for admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages are come. How does this book start out in the first chapter? God formerly spoke it all these ways, but hath at the end of these days spoken to us through His Son. So all the book of Hebrews is saying is preparation and fulfillment. And he really puts himself back there in that time and among those people. And he says the good things to come as if he's looking at it from their standpoint. So the contrast of this verse is between shadow and image. What is the contrast between a shadow and an image? Well, the shadow is dim. We even say the word shadowy. It wasn't clear. But the very image is clear. Don't you think that's the idea? The shadow is dim, the image is clear. The law having a shadow, a dim shadow, of the good things to come, not the very image of the things. What do you mean by things? Well, the relationships and the covenants and the sacrifices, those are the things. Can never with the same sacrifices year by year, which they, that's the priests, offer continually, make perfect them that draw nigh. So the law makes nothing perfect. Over the word perfect, put 7:19. The law made nothing perfect. Tonight, we're going to talk about the need for man to be made perfect, because he's not perfect. And since he's not perfect, he can't perfect himself. And he's going to have to be made perfect. And the law made nobody perfect. And yet, it was a type of that which could make us perfect. These sacrifices which the priests offer continually could not make them perfect that draw nigh, can never with these sacrifices make perfect them that draw nigh. What do we mean, class, by draw nigh? What's that an allusion to in the Old Covenant? Priest coming into God's presence. And of course, that happened daily with the daily sins, but what's the special thing now that that's talking about? Day of Atonement. Where you remember the priest, the high priest, came through the veil into the very presence of God, on top of which mercy seat, the ark there was the mercy seat. Here's the very presence of God. So he went in and drew nigh to God. And those Old Testament sacrifices never could do that. What do Pentecostalists think you mean by drawing near to God? Feelings, emotions, excitement, sensationalism, charismatic experiences. No. How do you draw nigh to God? You understand that in that Ark of the Covenant there was the law. Why was that in there? Because man needs to know he's a sinner and separated from God, and God can't stand sin. But on top of that law box, and that's what an ark is, a box, was the mercy seat, upon which blood was put, which spared the life of that high priest. Otherwise, coming into God's presence, he would have died. But because law has been broken, blood has to be shed, and therefore a man can be back in the presence of God again. Now, that's what we mean by draw nigh. Has nothing to do with our emotions, has nothing to do with excitement and feelings and that kind of thing. It's something we understand. Sin separates us from God. That's plain logic. Holy can't mix with unholy. But when atonement is made, which means that's 1 month, then God and man can be back together again. And that's what he means by drawing nigh. But these old sacrifices couldn't do it. Else would they, the sacrifices, not have ceased to be offered? That is, if they could make a man come in the presence of God, then wouldn't have to do it anymore, would you? They could make him perfect. Because the worshippers, having been once cleansed, would have been no more had no more consciousness of sin. Over the word consciousness, put Numbers 5:15. Here is just one of dozens and scores of Old Testament verses which say, this sacrifice is a memorial for sin. Numbers 5:15. When a man committed the sin, he had to offer sacrifice, which was a memorial of that sin. It reminded him of his sin. He had to pay for that sin. Often he had to give a life for that sin. So it was a memorial. And all those sacrifices could do was to make the sin conscious, to make a man aware of it. That's really the purpose of the law, isn't it? Romans 3:20, by works of the law shall no flesh be justified, for by the law cometh the knowledge of sin. So all of these sacrifices just brought the knowledge of sin. Every sacrifice was a memorial to sin. Every day of atonement was a remembrance, from which our brethren often say a rolling forward. But really it says a remembrance. They had to remember their sins every day. Now, how different that is from the New Covenant sacrifice, which wipes out the remembrance in God's mind. See how different? See how better? I like to back off from all of this and say, what was God trying to do? Well, he was trying to show me how great Jesus was in his sacrifice. He was trying to show me how effective, how adequate, how everything I need it was, because he carries these people through all of these acts and stages where it was inadequate what they did. And God wasn't pleased with those things. Why? They couldn't please him. It was impossible for the blood of the bulls and goats to take away sin. Well, why did he do all that then? So that I could go back there and see that that kind of thing can't please God and can't forgive sin and therefore must point to that which can. Shouldn't we be grateful, brethren, for the way God's gone to such pain? And just think of the centuries and centuries and centuries where he was working all this out. And now we can look back and see the whole picture just spread out before us. And that's so complimentary to me. I'm just blessed by having all of that done for me. Now verse 3 says, but in these sacrifices there is a remembrance made of sins year by year. There he's talking about the atonement day, year by year. But, for, it is impossible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sin. Over take away, put John 1:29. Behold the Lamb of God, which what? Taketh away the sins of the world. Now, the little goat ceremonially took away the sin. When they put their sins on the head of the goat and he'd bear their sins, that was typical, all right, but it didn't take away the sin. The people just still had their sins. Therefore, the blood of bulls and goats can't take away sins. And God was trying to show me how inadequate everything but the blood of Jesus was. So what we've said is the type was dim and shadowy, but the image, the substance, was what was the real thing. Any comment from you on that paragraph? Just brought it to remembrance. Now, of course, there's a sense in which it did take away sin. We'll get that in the next paragraph. Yes, George.
My comment would be that what a blessing it is. We don't have to remember sins that we've made upon
ourselves. Isn't that?
Whereas they have to go back and remember.
That's right. Isn't that a blessing? And my sins will not be remembered on the judgment either. A forgotten sin, over here in 8:12, he says, and their sins will I remember no more. That was the characteristic of the new covenant. That's how it was different. And you're going to say it again in 10:17, their sins, iniquities, I remember no more. Does that include the judgment? Mm-hmm. Yes. Because you see, sin in God's mind is obliterated and it can't be remembered anymore. Roger?
One thought I had about this was that I agree that God showed us the both sides of it in the Old and New Testament, the sacrifice of God's love.
Inability and ability.
Right. But even in the Old Testament, God required obedience.
Oh, yeah.
But much greater obedience as far as details of things that man had to do as compared to what we have to do today.
Chapter 10:19 is going to begin that very idea. Verse 28 is going to say, sore punishment for disobedience today. Now, about the details, brother, I don't know if I go along with you exactly on that. Yes, but I don't like the conclusion that they had to keep all the details and we don't. You weren't saying that, were you? That's right. So we are relieved from all of these carnal outward details, if that's what you mean. But certainly we have to be just as precise and even more so in doing exactly what God said. But we don't trust it. That's not the basis of our salvation. Yes, sir.
We have to look at Colossians 9:13 and 14. It seems like he's saying that the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of heifers will sanctify us to sin on
death. Because he says how much more?
Yes.
Well, we know he didn't mean that because he said it can't. 10:4 just says it can't.
Mm-hmm.
So then we know that's not true back then. No, if I made you think 13 and 14 meant that they do it, they could sanctify somewhat but not as much, then I didn't mean at all to leave that impression. Because they just couldn't. And verse 14 says, how much more shall? Meaning, back there, they couldn't. See, the contrast is between can't and can. All right, that's a good observation. I like your thinking.
Is he working on that if or if?
The Hebrew writer always says it backwards. He says it the way it isn't. And then you know the way it is. All right, anything else? The dim shadow pictured the exact full image. Now, this is a tricky chapter. This is a difficult paragraph we're hitting right now. These sacrifices were not pleasing to God. This sacrifice was. Now, I know that's what he's saying because I've read it a dozen times. But he doesn't just say it right out loud, does he? Wherefore, that is because it's impossible. If you'll do this class, it'll help you next time you come through, especially if you're teaching it. Every time he says wherefore, therefore, put it back to what it is. I have my arrow back to impossible. It's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. Wherefore? Well, now, if it's impossible for those sacrifices to do it, Jesus had to come make his sacrifice. That's what this paragraph is going to say. Wherefore, when he cometh into the world... He didn't even tell us who it was it? But he just said he. Hebrew writer has a lot of pronouns that he doesn't identify. But now he's quoting Psalms 40 and verse 6. Wherefore in he must mean the Son, cometh into the world. That means he existed before the world. And that means he existed before he came into the world. That's his pre-existence. That's his being with God before he was ever born. Not that he had a beginning when he was born. He said, and he makes it say that Jesus said what the psalmist said. But he doesn't say what the psalmist said. Take your left hand now and look at Psalms 40, verse 6. A New Testament writer, being inspired of God, can certainly make an Old Testament passage say what he wants it to say. The 40th Psalm of David is saying, I'm going to sing a new song because you've delivered me. I think he means from his enemies. I'm going to trust Jehovah. In verse 5 he says, many, O Jehovah my God, are the wonderful works which thou hast done, and thy thoughts which are us. If I would declare and speak of them, they're more than can be numbered. Well, now verse 6. Sacrifice and offering thou hast no delight in. The psalmist is praising God for his thoughts. And he says, his thoughts are so great, if I tried to say them, I couldn't number them. Now here's his thoughts. Sacrifice and offerings thou hast no delight in. Meal offerings. Mine ears thou hast opened. Look back at Hebrews. Sacrifice and offering thou wouldest not, but a body didst thou prepare for me. Wow. That's rather free reading by the Hebrew writer, wouldn't you say? But the Hebrew writer is making it said by Jesus. Now, what did David say?